So the thing about nuclear weapons is they are super expensive. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, December 23rd. Thanks for being with us today, and happy almost holiday. We have, as you might imagine, a lot of holiday stories coming up in the program. But before we do that, let's have a look at the top business stories of the week with our weekly wrap. For that, we have Neela Richardson of Redfin and Felix Salmon of Fusion. Hi, guys.
Hi, Molly.
Hi, Molly.
How are you?
We're good.
We're nearly there. We've nearly managed to make it over the finish line.
I thought that we could start today in a happy place. Let's talk about nukes.
Well, why not?
That's so happy.
Why not? Because it's the holidays. Here's what President-elect Donald Trump said in a tweet. The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability. Later, reportedly, according to the people in the pajamas on Morning Joe, he said, let it be an arms race. Our host, Kai Rizdahl, pointed out in a tweet that in addition to the foreign policy implications, which are large, nuclear weapons are super expensive.
Thing called the peace dividend, which those of us of a certain age remember from the early years of the Clinton administration. After the Berlin Wall comes down and the nuclear arms race comes to an end, suddenly all of the money that we used to be spending on nuclear weapons managed to get put into extremely productive investments instead. And that was the glory days of the U.S. economy. And what Donald Trump seems to be hell-bent on doing, if it's not just annihilating us all in the thermonuclear holocaust, is to just reverse that peace dividend and to slow everything down and to invest trillions of dollars into something with absolutely no useful purpose whatsoever.
Yeah, Neela, according to the Congressional Budget Office, we currently spend about $35 billion a year on our nuclear arsenal. One study said just plans to upgrade it could cost $1 trillion over 30 years. Is this something that we can even pay for in addition to all the infrastructure and other spending projects that this administration's talked about?
It doesn't look like it, not when you're also expecting a tax cut. It's what's interesting about this tweet is it comes after a meeting with both Boeing and Lockheed Martin. And so this whole idea of not mixing business and pleasure or not mixing church and state, you know, Trump disrupts all the mixing. We're mixing politics, trade policy, business, and an arms race all together in 140 characters. And that's what makes it scary.
I mean, is it something that then you think the government will start budgeting for, or are we still at the sort of like, okay, we just have to wait and see? Nobody's necessarily setting aside $1 trillion right now.
I don't think a tweet is going to move Congress just yet. Maybe we'll get there, but I think there
moves
are
markets.
Some steps between then and there, including an inauguration that have to be fulfilled before we can move in that direction. I don't see it as something materializing right yet.
Yeah, Ryan is not going to be super excited about the idea of spending that kind of money on an arms race, or any kind of money on an arms race, to be honest. I feel like a lot of what Donald Trump tweets does get picked apart in enormous detail by the news media, as it probably should, because, you know, he is the president-elect, but he doesn't really mean these things literally, and ultimately, I think, if you want to see what kind of legislation we're going to see in the Trump administration, you have to look to Congress to see what kind of legislation they're going to draw up and pass.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the other big news story of the week quickly. Deutsche Bank and Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse are going to pay a collective $12.5 billion to settle litigation over the risky subprime mortgages during the financial collapse. Now, in the case of Deutsche Bank, it's about half what the DOJ was originally, the Department of Justice was originally asking. Neela, is it enough?
You know what? It is largely symbolic at this point. It is half. It doesn't affect the bottom line as nearly as much as they feared it this fall when the Justice Department was going to go after a $14 billion settlement. Half of that settlement will be in loan modification and consumer relief. And so I'm sure the shareholders are cheering this result. But this is, again, a last-minute Trump response, I think, for an acknowledgement that we're heading into a more lenient regulatory environment. So this was an attempt by the Obama administration to keep checking those boxes on the financial reform and the financial crisis and making good on those new rules.
All right. That's all we've got time for today, guys. Thanks so much. On Wall Street today, stocks were mostly flat, but the markets pulled out a narrow win for the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Over the past year, we have talked a lot about coal on this program, mostly about coal companies going bankrupt. But it turns out that's not the whole story, because the world price for coal is actually way up this year. In fact, one global mining company reversed its emergency fire sale plan because its stock is up nearly 300%. Another mining giant is back to paying dividends to investors, and yet another is plowing money back into mines. So we wondered if the price rally can last and what it means for U.S. coal mining companies and their workers. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
This year's rally in coal prices blindsided a lot of market players. One benchmark price has doubled in 12 months, and a global mining stock index is up by a third. It all began with a shortage in China, where the government chose to cut domestic production to reduce air pollution and streamline the industry, says Andrew Cosgrove at Bloomberg Intelligence.
Chinese production cuts had unintended consequences, basically tripling prices. Imports reversed course. And that's basically what drove the entire rally.
American coal companies, which had suffered a string of bankruptcies, helped to serve the Chinese market. And now they could see some light ahead, says Lucas Pipes at the investment bank FBR.
There's a lot of investor interest. So I'm here on a 23rd of December answering not only your phone call, but I've had a pretty busy morning. 2017 could be a very interesting year for the coal industry.
But the longer-term outlook may not be so rosy. Coal in the U.S. has been overtaken by cheap natural gas from fracking. And globally, over the next few years, the influential International Energy Agency thinks world coal use will stall and plateau. Mining consultant John Morgan at the firm Respec agrees.
I think that the Chinese situation and India, where you're getting the increases in coal demand, I think are going to be balanced by decreases in other areas like Western Europe and the U.S.
Oh, and there's one more threat to coal, a global surge in wind and solar energy. It all has many wondering how long this recent coal rally can last. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
With the start of the new year, there will be new minimum wage hikes in lots of places around the country. And I say hikes plural because the new wages are all over the map. They're going up in at least 40 states, cities, and regions, and they'll range from 7 and change all the way up to $13 an hour or more. It is a patchwork quilt of wages, so how will it all come together for businesses and workers? Mitchell Hartman from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting digs in for us.
Congress hasn't raised the federal minimum wage, now $7.25 an hour, since 2009. But many states and localities have. Some of the rates are indexed to inflation or vary by business size or location.
The patchwork effect makes it wildly confusing for employers in these markets to run a business.
Michael Saltzman is with the Employment Policies Institute, which is supported in part by the restaurant industry. He says businesses that can't raise prices will close or move across the border to a state with a lower minimum. But economist William Rogers at Rutgers University doesn't think that's likely to happen very often.
These increases are not large enough to induce businesses moving, particularly in some of these low-wage sectors, restaurants, retail.
And those businesses may actually get a boost from higher spending by those low-wage workers on groceries or clothing. Economist Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute agrees there will be winners from a higher local minimum wage, but also losers.
The least skilled, least experienced workers in a city.
Because the low-wage employers that need them are more likely to move out of town, leading to
fewer employment opportunities in the places where they live, higher prices when they go shopping in their neighborhoods.
I asked Constance Palaya, who owns the Motel Del Rogue in rural Grants Pass, Oregon, how she deals with her four housekeeping employees.
We've always paid over the minimum wage. It's not entirely benevolent. It pays off. All of these people have been here for over 2 years.
And she says that's a benefit in a place where it's hard to find workers who will stay around a while. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is both Christmas Eve and the start of Hanukkah. History would suggest that some last-minute shopping is happening right this second. It's probably happening in stores because those shipping windows are closing like now. But how much of the rest of the season's shopping happened in stores? A few malls have been trying to compete with online shopping by moving beyond the annual visit from Santa. Amy Kiley of WABE in Atlanta has that story.
Hundreds of malls have closed in the last decade, and dozens more are struggling. But this one, Atlantic Station, is doing pretty well. The Atlanta Mall charges retailers about 20% over the market rate and rarely has vacancies. It attracts about 9 million customers a year, like Caroline Long. She usually buys jewelry on websites like Etsy. Today, she wanted to come to an event at Atlantic Station, so she bought some earrings here.
So I heard about the Crafts and Drafts event, and then I wanted to come check it out, but I decided to go to H&M while I was in the area because I wanted to do some shopping for myself.
Multiply her story by millions of customers, and it adds up to big profits. But Atlantic Station wasn't always such a moneymaker. The story of its turnaround starts in 2009. Back then, mall developer Mark Toro didn't have much work and was kind of bored.
Our industry was literally dead. I spent a lot of time walking the streets of Midtown and reading books and didn't go to the office much because there wasn't much to do.
One of the books Toro read was called The Experience Economy. Toro says it changed the way he thought about his industry. So what was the big revelation? I asked the book's co-author, Joe Pine, and he started with something people already know.
It just becomes so easy to sit there at home and do all of your shopping and have the packages just to, you know, magically arrive at your door, you have to have a reason to go to stores.
That reason had been sale prices, but Pine calls those a death spiral for modern stores. Online retailers have lower overhead costs, so they tend to win price battles. Here's the part Toro and others hadn't considered as much.
You've got to choose the opposite way of let's provide a reason for people to come into our stores other than just the lowest price. That reason is provide events and experiences that engage and create memories.
Pine says some retailers have been doing this for years. Lululemon holds yoga classes. Some REI outlets have rock climbing walls. But Pine says only a few malls have started using experiences. He names Mall of America in Minneapolis and The Grove in L.A. Here's where Mark Toro comes back into this story. He's managing partner of North American Properties, and in early 2011, his company bought Atlantic Station. It has a fair amount of outdoor space, like a grassy plaza called Central Park.
Central Park was a perfect place to host concerts, yoga, Mother's Morning Out. We actually brought on a USTA tennis tournament to host on the property.
Toro's company trademarked the term experience maker. They're four employees whose entire job is to create retail experiences. They also invite outside groups to hold events at Atlantic Station, like the craft fair that prompted Caroline Long to buy those earrings here. This year, Toro's company sold Atlantic Station for double its investment price. Now Toro and his company, North American Properties, are building up other developments around Atlanta. And they're getting ready to take their vision of the retail experience to other states. In Atlanta, I'm Amy Kiley for Marketplace.
Okay, here's a tech vision of the future. Imagine that instead of shopping at the mall at all, you just said, Alexa, order my mom a fuzzy scarf. Well, you can, because the big tech trend of 2017 is voice control, or put in a slightly more nerdy way, conversation-based systems, which are increasingly how we're going to interact with machines. Amazon's voice-controlled internet-connected speaker, the Echo, is an example. Google has the Google Home device and its voice-controlled Google Assistant on Android phones. Microsoft and Apple are in this game, too. And as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, the world of apps and touchscreens better figure out how to keep up.
Hey, Siri, why can't children ever find their shoes in the morning?
I don't know. Frankly, I've wondered that myself.
Oh, well, it was worth a shot. But it turns out that the future of artificial intelligence, or AI, won't just be about the smartphones in our pockets, but
every device that we use.
Patrick Moorhead is an analyst with Moore Insights and Strategy. He says companies have moved well beyond simple voice recognition.
In 5 years, I would expect at least half of the consumer devices that come out to have some form of digital assistant baked into them.
Dennis Mortensen is the CEO of X.AI. He says in the future, virtual assistants like Amazon's Alexa are going to be the new apps.
Alexa will have a basic set of skills, and then there's a marketplace for additional skills that you want to extend her with.
Mortensen's startup makes a digital assistant called Amy for scheduling meetings. He says the next iteration of AI will replicate human behaviors, not to convince you that they are human.
But I do see a point in humanizing the agent to the extent you know it's a machine, but the machine is doing a job so well that you want to treat it like a human.
Both Amazon and Google's smart speakers are hoping for a bump from holiday sales. Meanwhile, Microsoft's entry into the market, a digital assistant called Cortana, won't be available until next year. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And on New Year's night, we are now working towards making this exactly accurate with the leap second.
Big Ben is getting a facelift. It turns out that clock was always 2 seconds behind. But first, let's do the numbers. In light trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 14 points, less than a 10% to close at 19,933. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, a 0.25% to finish at 5462. The S&P 500 was up 2 points, about a 10% to end the day at 2263. For the week, the Dow was up 0.5%. The NASDAQ also gained 0.5%, and the S&P 500 advanced 0.2%. Healthcare stocks in particular glowed. Insurer Aetna was up 1%. Allergan, the maker of Botox, plumped up 2.6%. Drug maker Bristol Myers Squibb gained 1.4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. We are almost out of time to indulge in extreme Christmas kitsch. So let's do it. There is a store in Pasadena, California, that has provided the Southland with holiday decorations for more than half a century. The place is called Stats. Inside, you will find an explosion of Christmas stuff. Snow globes, robot Santas, ornaments, so many lights, you can probably see this place from space. So I'm going to say it is a fitting place for our latest installment of Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
Here's that story.
I'm Damon Stathatos. I'm the owner of Stats Floral Supply. My father started Stats in 1962. At the time that they were painting the sign, it probably was more economical to paint Stats rather than Stathatos, something like that. But my first memories were during our Christmas vacation when I was in second grade, testing light sets at the light counter and seeing some of my classmates on the other side as customers. For a long time, it was easier for us to be very different than everybody else in the market. As time has gone on, big box stores have necessarily included this segment of the business in their business. We were forced to sell our major warehouse. We advertised a complete inventory liquidation, which everybody naturally read as that we were going out of business. But sometimes people have a knack of just reading the headline and skipping the rest. Our challenge this season was to get the word out that, no, we're not closed. Like I say, my father started in 1962. Unfortunately, he passed away in the middle of last year. My father was the greatest guy that certainly that I ever have known. He was very tough in business, but he had a heart of gold. I realize now that all those years of exposure, even when I was young, really set the whole foundation, you know, going further into my adult life.
That was Stats store owner Damon Stathatos in Pasadena, California. If you did not plan a holiday trip to London this year, you have missed your chance to visit Big Ben, one of the world's most famous clock towers, at least for a while. Big Ben, which is officially called the Elizabeth Tower, is closing to the public for a three-year, $36 million facelift. The London landmark is, of course, a popular destination for millions of tourists, and its bells will be silenced for around 6 months. That is really bugging our friends at the BBC, because Big Ben is seen or heard every single day on their radio and television programs. Nicola Stanbridge took a last trip up the tower before the work begins.
Steve Jaggs is the keeper of the Great Clock.
You're now entering the Elizabeth Tower, climbing 334 steps to the belfry.
Soon to have a winter coat of scaffolding, a necessity from time to time, as described in Pathé Archive from 1955.
Among Parliament's many famous voices, only one is heard round the world year in and year out, that of Big Ben himself at the top of his great tower. So great a public figure requires careful grooming to keep him in trim, and that's a major task.
My guys, they have to climb here three times a week to do the clock winding. I'm sorry, let me go right back.
Where are we now?
We're behind what we call the south face of the Elizabeth Tower. It will be necessary to remove this lattice framework and remove the glass. And we are now sourcing a glass identical to this because this is no longer produced.
The clock tower was completed in 1859, designed by Sir Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin, after fire destroyed the old Palace of Westminster. At its heart, the mechanism room, where we pause next.
There is a pendulum swinging. So that tick that you hear in the background, which is very therapeutic when you're up here doing a time change late at night, it's a two-second swing click. We adjust the speed of the clock to make it go faster or to make it go slower by adding just one of the old decimal pennies to the pendulum. We like to keep this clock within 2 seconds of accuracy. And on New Year's night, we are now working towards making this exactly accurate with the leap second. We're now coming up to the quarter past the hour chimes, with the wheels and the ironwork going round that go up to what we call the link room, and then they go up to the quarter bells upstairs. They will start moving. We've still got another quarter of the way to go to the actual bells. You're now in the belfry, and this is where Big Ben, the bell, hangs, with the four quarter bells actually wrapped around this wrought iron frame that supports 25 tonne of bell weight. When the clock tower was first built and the bell was first commissioned, you could hear the bell as far away as Tower Bridge. That's just not possible today because, obviously, of all the London traffic noise, more background noise in London, drowning it out.
When you hear Big Ben, you're home again.
We couldn't live without the sound for too long, could we?
No, we could not do without the sound. And one of the reasons why BBC actually recorded the sound and broadcast the sound to the world during the Second World War is to let our troops know abroad that London hadn't fallen, gave them a reassuring noise of home.
You'll cry when you hear his song.
He was close to the hammer now as anybody has ever been to that hammer. In the motor room downstairs, the bit that actually makes all this work, the wheels are starting to move. Here we go. Very British, and it's a sound that we cannot do without. And we have deadlines that we have to meet. For example, Remembrance Sunday. We will also be sounding bells for New Year's Eve, because you can't have New Year's Eve without the sound of Big Ben.
That was Nicola Stanbridge of the BBC. This final note before we go is news you can use. I think most of us can agree that the holidays in this modern era involve a lot of cardboard boxes. And let's be honest, a lot of those cardboard boxes are from Amazon. All right, so here's how to get rid of those boxes and do a good thing. This year, Amazon is participating in a goodwill program called the Give Back Box. You pack up the stuff you want to donate in an Amazon box or a box from another participating retailer. You print out a shipping label for free, and you take it to the post office to send it to Goodwill as a donation. Today, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 were all up just a hair. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fergali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president. And I am Molly Wood. We will see you all on Monday. Have a great holiday weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.